Mysterious Aliyah. This Aliyah, the seventh Aliyah of Mishpatim, is not simple. There's a lot to try to decipher. It is somewhat mystical, somewhat mysterious. We're not going to be able to talk about everything, especially because there are some major, major themes in this Aliyah that we have to touch upon. So we'll go for some highlights, and maybe there'll be an opportunity some other time to expand on some of this. There is a little bit of synergy potential here as well, as we'll see. So I'll call attention to what we can, and then we'll try to preserve the opportunity to fill in more details when circumstances allow. So the seventh Aliyah starts off in an unusual way because it's talking about the promise of the Jews in the land, and the Aliyah, as AJ was pointing out before, stops at a point where you wouldn't really expect it. It talks about this promise that the Jews will be fruitful, will have children, losia mishakela v'yakara barzecha es mispar yamecha amale, that you're not going to have any lost children, you're not going to be barren, you're going to that have children, and your days will be filled out, which is an interesting language because it sounds like it's a promise of a long life, perhaps, but it poses the question, Mispar Yamecha makes it sound like you have some set number, so then presumably if you have a number of days, so then they're going to be filled. So what does it mean to say that Mispar Yamecha Amal, either you have a Mispar or you don't? So there's some discussion about that in the Mefarshim, and some suggest that it refers to fully living your life and living to your potential, not having any wasted time, and something along those lines. Harisham Shnufal Hirsch notes that you would think that this pasuk really would go with the previous Aliyah. And here, to just start with what goes next about the destruction of the enemies of the Jewish people. So he suggests that really they are connected, to show that if the Jews were really properly zocha, if the Jews were really worthy, they wouldn't even have to vanquish the enemies. If the enemies are not worthy, then they will disappear. But it wouldn't have been the Jews' job to have to take on that effort. So that itself is something that's connected to the promise and connected to this whole covenant here. So the psukim continue, and we'll rush through these because again, there's so many other things we have to talk about. But say Masi Ashalach Lefanecha VeHamosi Es Kol Am Asher Tavo Bohem VeNasati Es Kol Eivach Eilecha Oref. So I'm going to send in front of you my Ema, my fear, and destroy the people who you are going to come to, and all of your enemies will turn around. VeShalachti Es Atziru Lefanecha VeGersha Es Achivi Es Aknani. I'm going to send these hornets that are going to drive out all these other nations. Then even that, there's a chachma too. I'm not going to make the land all of a sudden empty because then animals are going to come in. It's an interesting idea which is discussed elsewhere in the Torah. I think we've talked about it in the past parshas here. So even that is a whole system to how that's done. Ma'at ma'at agarshanu miponecha ad asher tifra v'nachalto es aretz. So then it's going to be a little bit of the getting rid of those nations until you're going to be big enough and you're going to inherit the land. V'shati es gevulcha miyamsuf v'yad yam plishtim midbar ad hadar. So I'm going to give you boundaries from the Red Sea to the Sea of the Plishtim, and from the desert to the river, and I'm going to deliver these inhabitants into your hand, then you'll drive them out. So you should not make a bris with them and with their gods. So here that's an interesting language. What exactly were you thinking? Maybe you should make a deal with their gods. That clearly is not the message the Jewish people are supposed to be picking up. So the Aznayim L'Torah, L'Skarav notes that you might think that God will Hashalom, we should try to make peace wherever we can, so therefore we should make covenants with these nations, and we won't be all bit of a czar. We'll be separate from that. So therefore, the Torah emphasizes that no, that that's the same thing as Eloheihem, that's the same thing as making a deal with their gods, and that's also not acceptable. Rather, lo yeshu ba'artzacha penyachetiros chali ki savodes Eloheihem ki elochol amokesh. You have to understand they're going to be a trap for you, they're going to cause you problems, you can't have them with you. Yo Moshe Amar, Alel Hashem, Atah, Yaron, Nadav, Yaviu, Vishivim Mizikne Yisrael, Vishtach Visam Barochok. So then God says to Moshe, come up together, you and Aaron and Nadav and Avihu, and 70 of the Zakanim, and you shall worship from a distance. V'nigash Moshe Levado Hashem, V'heimlo Yigashu, V'amlo Yalu Imel. And Moshe, he himself, he's going to come near. The rest should not come near, and the people shouldn't come up with him. V'yavo Moshe v'yisaper la'am es kol divrei Hashem v'es kol ha-mishpatim v'yan kol am kol echa v'yomru kol ha-dvarim asher divrei Hashem na'aseh. So here's the first step. This is the first phase of the very significant phrase, which we'll have the end of in a minute. But initially, they say everything that God has commanded, we're going to do. Vayichtav Moshe, and Moshe writes, es kol divrei Hashem v'yashkein baboker. Rashi writes here from the Mechilta that this, what he wrote down, was up until this point, from everything from Bereishis until Matan Torah. Vayizban mizbeach tachas ahar v'shem asrei matzeva l'shem asar shivtei Yisrael. And he makes matzeva, 12 matzevas for the 12 shvatim. Vayishlach es nari b'nei Yisrael. Vialu olos v'yizbuchu zvachim shlamim l'Hashem parim. And he has the b'chor, come, the b'choros come and offer karbonos. V'yikach Moshe chatzi hadam. Rashi explains here that the half of the blood was split by a malach. V'yasam ba'agonos v'chatzi hadam zarak al hamizbeach. So he splits the blood, or the Malachim splits the blood, and he puts them in the basins. And this half he throws on the Mizbeach. V'yikach Sefer HaBris. V'yikra ba'ozne ha'am v'yomru kol asher dibur Hashem na'aseh v'nishma. So he took the Sefer HaBris, this book of the covenant, and he reads it to the people, and what do they say? Everything that it says, we will hear, and we will do, and we will hear. Na'aseh v'nishma. So, of course, this is one of our key phrases, one of our key sources of pride, this whole idea of Na'aseh v'nishma. This is something that we are extremely proud of, and the Gemara tells us to be proud of it. The Gemara Masechet Shabbos and Daf Peches tells us that this is something that the Malachim were impressed with, that the angels, when they saw that the Jews were makdim Na'aseh v'nishma, that they said, who taught the Jews the secret? How did they know to do that? And they came down and they gave each of the Jews 2 crowns. So there's a lot to try to figure out. You know, what exactly is so great about saying Na'aseh v'nishma, saying that we will do, before saying that we will listen, before saying that we will learn. And there are a couple of major explanations. So just to mention a few, to focus maybe on one major one first, the Beis HaLevi is perhaps among the most well-known explanations about this. And the Beis HaLevi has a comment which appears in a number of places. You can find this in the Beis HaLevi Al HaTorah. The Beis HaLevi Al HaTorah does not get much farther than this. The Beis HaLevi Al HaTorah is only on Bereishis and about half of Shmos. So this is towards the end of the Beis HaLevi Al HaTorah. But he also writes this in his introduction to his tshuvas, the essence of the sport. And also in the tshuvas themselves, in Simen Vav, he talks about this point as well. So at least in the 3 places in the writings of the Beis HaLevi, you can find the essence of this idea, where he notes that it sounds a little funny that, first of all, what is so special about saying Na'aseh before Nishma? The emphasis on the order, why is that such a big deal? B'shah shehigdimu, Na'aseh v'nishma. And why did the Malachim give them all 2 crowns? Okay, give them a crown, that's enough, that's pretty impressive. What's pshat on 2 crowns? So the Beis HaLevi explained, and there are many others who say like this also. So the Rashi of Karen Biavna has a sikha very much along the same lines. that essentially the point is that we understand that in order to do, you're going to have to learn the Torah. We can't perform the Torah, we can't fulfill the Torah without knowing the rules. So, Mamela, you have to learn in order to do. So to say Na'aseh, Na'aseh implies Nishma. Right? Nishma, to learn, really is included in Na'aseh. So what's the idea of Na'aseh v'Nishma? It means that we will learn. You shouldn't read it as we'll do and then we will learn, because that doesn't make so much sense. It can't be that you're only going to learn after you do. You're not going to know what to do. So rather, you have to understand it as Nishma v'Na'aseh v'Nishma, because since you have to learn in order to do, so it means we will learn to know what to do. We will do. And even after we know what to do, we will still learn. So essentially what this highlights is the notion of Talmud Torah just for the sake of Talmud Torah, not just for the sake of practice, but for the sake of Talmud Torah itself. And he mentions this, again, in a number of contexts. One of the reasons he mentions this is because he draws a distinction when it comes to men and women. The notion of women being pturus from the mitzvah of Talmud Torah, so it suggests that there are these two dimensions. So the dimension of learning, even without any connection to practical halacha, that women are pturus from. But because most mitzvos women are chayavos in, and those mitzvos have details that they need to know, so they're chayavos to learn that Torah that's relevant to what they need to do. So they're chayav in that sense of Talmud Torah, but in the sense of the Talmud Torah beyond this, they're not chayavos in. So that's what he writes in the Tshuvos and Siman Vav, and he's drawing on the same vort that he has in the Hakdama, and that he has in the Sefer and Chumash as well. So along those lines, he says that's why the Malachim came and they gave two crowns, because B'shal Shekdimu, that had they said Nishma V'Na'aseh, it would have been one Kabbalah, it would have been one idea, that we will learn the Torah so that we know what to do, and then we'll do the mitzvahs, we'll fulfill the commandments of the Torah. But because they said it the other way around, because they said Na'aseh V'Nishma, so then it becomes, like we said, Nishma V'Na'aseh V'Nishma, that we will learn to do, and then also we're also Mekabel to learn as well, so that that learning is a separate Kabbalah. Essentially, they turned it into two acceptances, and therefore it makes sense that they should have two prizes, they should have two crowns. And this is similar to a point that was made by Rabbi Saul Salanter, that the Gemara Masechet Sanhedrin tells us that there are certain, at least according to one opinion in the Gemara, there are certain mitzvos in the Torah that address scenarios that never come up. So Ben Sora Mora, Lahayiv Onivra, doesn't happen. Bayis Samanduga, a house with Saras, that doesn't happen. And Ir Hanidachas, the city that's all over the Zara, doesn't happen. So the Gemara asks, well, if that's the case, so then why do we have descriptions of them in the Torah? Why do we have them? So it says the Gemara, drosh v'kabel schar. So you should study them, and you'll get schar. So Rav Shaul asks, well, is that really necessary, that we don't have enough Torah to learn? We don't have enough mitzvos that we can get schar talmud Torah? That we were going to run out, so the Torah had to continue to give some more mitzvos just so we'll be able to fill our time, otherwise we would have been bored. We certainly have enough halacha l'maisa to study that could easily take up all our time, and we'll get schar talmud Torah for that. So he writes in the Or Yisrael, Rav Shaul Salanter, that the idea is that we need to emphasize the value of Torah study even just for its own sake, even separate from anything practical, even dinim that are never going to come up. That's something that we have to also value, and therefore the Gemara is highlighting that. Now this is somewhat of a complex point, because we do greatly value learning amanas lasos, so that learning to do, partially because that just represents a high madrega of learning, the notion of lasuke shmeisa alibi de hilchusa, to have such a clear understanding of what we're learning that we're able to come to a halachic conclusion, itself represents a very high madrega. But also, the notion that we have a living practical Torah is itself considered to be a major value, and that's something, I guess, a little bit of synergy, but in this case, complementary synergy, just to fill out the picture. So, beginning of next week, we'll talk about Osek B'Torah and its relation to mitzvot. So there is a core theme of learning Almanas Lasos, and yet there's also this aspect too that we can't forget and eliminate completely the idea of learning just for the sake of learning separate from Lasos. He doesn't particularly make this point, but you could note also that what Rav Shaul Salanter said, okay, drosh v'kabel schar, but it's for these three mitzvos that don't actually come up. So it's 3 out of 613. So still the vast, vast majority of the Torah is there to be applied to the practical situations. We shouldn't de-emphasize that to say it's not important. The point simply seems to be that together with that, just the idea of learning for its own sake has to be something that we can appreciate as well. Now, it's interesting that the Beis HaLevi's namesake, his great-grandson, Yeshua Ber Soloveitchik of our yeshiva, so he has a essay about this. Rabbi Bezdin, who wrote the Reflections of the Rav, wrote up an essay in Ber Soloveitchik's name, which has a different approach to this. He says, the whole question of Nasa v'Nishma, the idea that we are so proud of just jumping in, it doesn't seem to be something to be proud of. It seems to be irresponsible. That if somebody says, you want to buy a car, and you say, yeah, I'll just take you without looking at it. Or if somebody says, I have a shidduch for you, and you say, oh, I'll marry her without meeting her. I'm not interested in any of the details. So we don't say that's a smart person. We say that's somebody who's not making decisions carefully. So why are we so impressed here, the Jews jumping in? So Soloveitchik has an essay about, quoting from the Kabbalistic concepts, there's something called the Ratzon Elyon and the Ratzon Tachton. There's a higher desire and a lower desire. That on one level, in the very practical, mundane world, so we make decisions by adding up the pros and the cons, looking at what are the features, looking at what is a part of the whole story, and we decide what it is that we're going to go with. But there's a Ratzon Elyon also, there's a higher level of consciousness that just connects. And that connection transcends anything that is rational and natural. And the Jews were saying that we connect to this in a higher sense, and that was what turned on. And the details we can find out later. So the truth is, maybe there is a little bit to connect the two traditions here of the great-grandfather and the great-grandson of the Beis HaLevi and Rav Soloveitchik. That the idea is learning because of the relationship that it creates with the Ribono Shel. So feeling that kesher and God saying, listen, here's my Torah, and we're saying, great, we want it, whatever it is, we want it. That whole kesher, that's something that represents the fact that we feel this higher level connection, and that exists in the type of Torah that's not even necessary for any practicalities, but is just to encounter Torah in and of itself. And of course, also to fill in the gaps here between the Soloveitchik lineage, that this is a part of the Brisker tradition in some parts of the family, to focus especially on non-practical aspects of learning, whether it's in areas of the Talmud that do affect practical life, or specifically in areas that have less relevance to life as practiced today, whatever it is, but the notion of being very connected to an abstract Talmud Torah is a little bit in line with this whole idea that that's something that we should value together with the notion of practical halacha. So these are among the explanations. Rav Goldwicht, Rav Shiv Kamer Avner, Chaim Yaakov Goldwicht, in his essay in Paris Mishpatim, it's very similar to the Beis HaLevi's point, but he adds there that is also the pshat the Gemara says in Nedarim, that the Gemara asks, Alma Avda Haaretz, why was Yerushalayim destroyed? Pasuk in Yirmiyahu, and the Gemara says, Lazvav Mistarasi, that they left the Torah. And the Gemara says, what does it mean they left the Torah? They didn't leave the Torah, they were very involved in Torah study. Rather, Shol Berchu Ala Torah Tchila, that they didn't recite the Berchus HaTorah. And everyone asks, is that really it? That's the real Avera, that the Yerushalayim was destroyed because they didn't make Berchus HaTorah. Shagasari has a discussion that the Berchus HaTorah is machlokas if it's even Daraisa. So it must be a Raya, there must be Daraisa, because if Yerushalayim was destroyed for not making Berchus HaTorah, it's got to at least be a Din Daraisa. But that's not really going to answer the question either. Even if it's Din Daraisa, it doesn't seem to really fully address the situation. So it's often explained that the Gemara there is not asking what avera did they do. That we know the Gemara elsewhere says they did a lot of terrible averas. The Gemara here is asking a different question. It's saying, since we know they were involved in Torah study, so then why is it that they were able to be so misbehaved? Why is it that they were not affected by their Torah study to rise to a higher level of spirituality? So to that, the Gemara says, Al shelo berchu o Torah tchila. And the suggestion is Rigolda points out, that apparently they didn't relate to the Torah as its own mitzvah. They saw the Torah as like a hechsher mitzvah, to go back a little bit to our sugya from the first day of last semester, that they saw it as a step to something else, as maybe something that's necessary so you know halacha, but they didn't see it as independently valuable, and therefore their relationship with Torah was fundamentally flawed. So these are some approaches to Nasa v'Nishma. There are a few others as well. If you look, for example, Rav Moshe Feinstein in the Dibros, in the Darash Moshe, so he has a few points here. Among the points that he makes is that we are saying that we are going to commit to the Torah even when we don't fully understand the nature of what the mitzvah is asking, but we're going to do it anyway, and then commit to continue trying to learn about it in continuation while we are already in fulfillment of the mitzvah. And that is an important idea as well, that he doesn't spell it out exactly, but I think what he's getting at is that we shouldn't think that our relationship is okay, we'll evaluate every mitzvah, and if it makes sense to us, if it seems like it's a good idea, then we'll do it. So no, we're going to do the mitzvah anyway. And the idea that we're going to delve into the mitzvah and learn it in as much detail as we can, it's not because we're deciding whether or not we're going to do the mitzvah. It's because once we're doing the mitzvah, we want to have a full exposure to everything it has to offer us. But it's not as a condition to do the mitzvah in the first place. So therefore, this phrasing of Nasa v'Nishma is helpful. We're saying first, yeah, we're in. We're doing the mitzvah. And we also want to learn everything about it so that we can fully get the value of the experience, but one shouldn't think that it's a part of a condition for fulfilling it. And the Sefer Beichia, he has a discussion, quotes from earlier sources, that the idea of Nasa v'Nishma is that Torah is unique in that it has to really be lived in order to be understood. That one can't think, okay, I'll just understand it fully intellectually, and then I will perform it. That a big part of the learning experience and of understanding it is you just have to live it and feel it and internalize it, and then you have a shot at understanding what it's about. And he quotes from the Dubner Magid, and says that that's also a pshat in the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos, a whole different pshat. The Mishnah says, Kachi Darkei Shel Torah, this is the path of Torah, and Pas Melach Tochol, you should eat only a little bit of bread with salt and have some lousy water and sleep on the floor. And if you do this, then you'll be well off. So he has a completely different interpretation of that Mishnah. He says that, what is the path of Torah? What is Torah like? So imagine if somebody would say to you, oh, you want a good meal, have some bread with salt and have some spoiled water. So you're going to say, I'm not going to do that. That's going to taste awful. I'm not interested in that. So we're telling you, listen, do it and you'll see. So you'll do it and then you'll see, okay, this isn't something I could appreciate at all in the description, but now that I live it, so now I'm able to understand this is something I was never able to imagine. And the Mishnah goes on to say, Vimata Osakei, the Shrach will tell you, you'll do it, you'll see that you'll be happy. It doesn't sound so good, but you'll live it and you'll find that this will be something that will be tremendously beneficial to you. So this is, that's also the idea, that the Torah isn't something that, not that it sounds bad, but it's something that we can't comprehend just on paper. We have to actually live it, and that's a major step towards the comprehension. And as we're advancing towards Purim, so it's especially relevant. I mean, I guess not a really a coincidence. Parsha is always a few weeks before Purim. But there is the a very glaring question, because that same daf, you can't, it's funny, like you can't miss this question, because the same daf and Shabbos and daf Peches, the Gemara says that we had to be forced to keep the Torah, that we had to be forced to accept the Torah. Kof aleim harki gigas, that God took the mountain and he turned it upside down and he held it over our heads and he said, you're interested, good, you accept it, good, otherwise Shem take for us, we're going to drop the mountain on your heads and things won't end well. So it does seem to be a pretty blatant question. That doesn't that contradict Nasa Benishma? So which is it? So we're so proud that we eagerly accepted the Torah, or no, the Torah had to be forced upon us, and we're not really so excited about it. So Tosus raises the question over there, and Tosus says that we had to have a full commitment because maybe afterwards we were going to get so scared we were going to go back on it. But there is an answer, many quote from the Medrash Tanchuma in Parshas Noach, that it's the difference between Torah Shebichsav and Torah Shebal Peh. The Torah Shebichsav, that we were happy to accept, we said, Nasa V'nishma, but Torah Shebal Peh, so that had so much that was scary to us, and so much that seemed like it was too burdensome, that we weren't interested in taking that. And of course, Baruch Hu says, this is the whole package deal, you can't just take part of it, and this is something that you are fully compelled to take the whole thing. And then the Gemara says that after the time of Purim, that's when we fully accepted it. That's when we said, Kimu v'kiblu ha-Yehudim, that the Jews, at that point, the Gemara has a discussion, what exactly does that pasuk mean, Kimu v'kiblu? So the Gemara suggests that, Gemara Shabbos suggests that it means Kimu masha kiblu kvar, that they accepted that which they had already committed to, and that is the Torah. And it's because they didn't fully accept it at that time that what we're reading now, the Gemara is telling us, was a pressured acceptance, and it wasn't really of full will, and it was only after the miracle of Purim that they were able to fully accept it. There's really a lot to say about this. It's hard to get everything in one discussion, but so the whole idea that Purim represents a full Kabbalah Satorah is one of the major themes of Purim. And among the many things to say about this, Rav Huttner has an essay about this in the Sefer on Purim. And he writes that there is a Gemara in Maseches Megillah that says that whoever is Mevi Davar B'Shem Omro is Mevi Geula L'Olam. That if you quote something with a proper attribution, so then you bring redemption to the world. So the Gemara quotes that from Mordechai, and that Mordechai was careful that he told Esther about the plot to kill Achashverosh, and she quotes it in his name. So the Gemara says that you have to be Mevi Davar B'Shem Omro. So Rav Huttner discusses what's the relationship between quoting properly and Purim and Geula. So he says, what is Geula? He says, Geula is restoring something to its source. When we're in Gullus, we are disconnected from our source, and that's what it means to be in exile, and Geula means to be brought back to its source. So if you have a disembodied quote, if you have a sentence, but you don't know who said it, so that's an exiled quote, essentially, that is disconnected from its source of life. So to say who it is who said it, to bring it back to its original quoter, so that is a geula, that's a redemption, and that's why we associate it with maybe geula leolam. And he says, so too, the same way, if you have a quote without an author, so it's a gullus, so the opposite of that, but the same kind of thing, is if you have a quote with an author, but the author doesn't really want to say it, he's being forced to say it. So the Jews are saying Nasa V'Nishma, but they're being forced to say it because the mountain's held over their head. So it's also disconnected from the source because it doesn't really represent what they feel. But then comes Purim, and they're reconnected to that. So that is also a sense of Geula the other way. So all of this is about bringing the author and the quotation together in a harmonious way. That's connecting an idea with its source. That's Geula, and that's what Purim's about. Just I can mention another idea. I think we mentioned this last year at our Purim Suda together, but this idea that the Gemara has over here, that Kimu v'kiblu ha-Yehudim, so Kimu masha kiblu kfar, so, or just to go back a line, so the Gemara says, Amar v'acha bar Yaakov mekan modo rabba la raisa, that this could be a big excuse not to keep the Torah. We say we didn't do it willingly. So Amar Rava, Be'afal Pikin Hadar Kiblu Me'Achashverosh, the Jews did come and fulfill, accept the Torah fully in the days of Achashverosh. D'chsiv Kimu V'Kiblu HaYehudim Kimu Masha Kiblu Kfar, that they upheld that which they initially had accepted. So some ask, the Gemara in Megillah has a different drasha on the same pasuk, that the pasuk Kimu V'Kiblu, the pasuk there, the Gemara interprets as meaning that kimu lamala masha kimu lamata, that which was done down here was endorsed up in Shemayim. So I think the Vilna Gaon raises the question, if I remember correctly, someone pointed out once from the Vilna Gaon, that how can the Gemara quote two different interpretations of the same pasuk? So what does the pasuk mean? Does the pasuk mean like this Gemara says here in Shabbos, that they accepted the Torah? Or does the Gemara mean like the Gemara says in Megillah, that in Shemayim they endorsed what was happening down here? So I believe the Vilna Gaon explains a fascinating idea, that the difference is the Kshri and the Ksiv, that the pasuk has a Kri and a Ksiv. So the Ksiv is Kimu V'Kiblu, and it's Kimu V'Kibel, rather, and the Kri is Kimu V'Kiblu. So the Gemara in Megillah is darshaning the Kri, is darshaning the Ksiv of, sorry, I keep saying it the other way around, is darshaning Kimu V'Kiblu, and this is darshaning Kimu V'Kibel, as it says, Dechsiv. So here, that this our Gemara says, Dechsiv, and if I remember correctly, the Gemara in Megillah says Shademar. So it's interesting because the question could be asked, how do we know that this pasuk is talking about Matan Torah? How do we know that that pasuk in Megillah Esther has anything to do with Kabbalah HaTorah? The Torah Tamima raises that question, and he suggests that maybe it's a similar kind of structure. Kimu V'Kiblu sounds like Nasa V'Nishma, so maybe that's how they knew there was a relationship between the two. But maybe you could say that the Ksiv of the Kibel, of singular, so where do you find a plural language mysteriously expressed in singular, or a plural idea mysteriously expressed in singular? Right, that the Jews were all considered to be like one entity. So maybe that was the clue that this pasuk is talking about Matan Torah, that a plural idea expressed in a singular word, so that's supposed to harken back to Nasa V'Nishma. Maybe that's where the clue to this, and that's how Chazal got that idea. Okay, but a lot to say about this. There's more to say about it also, just to mention maybe one or two other ideas. So there's a Medrash Pliya that says that, okay, so it was good that the Jew says Nasa Menishma, but what about the fact that they said about the Egel Azav, Eile Lehefe Yisrael, was that also good? So, what's Pshat? And we know that that was bad. That by the Egel Azav, the Elu Elhecha Yisrael, so the Medrash Pliya says, okay, Nasa V'Nishma, that was good. And saying, this is your God, that the Egel Azav is the Jewish God, was that also good? So clearly it was not good, right? So what's the Medrash coming to say? So there's a discussion about this in the Sefer Mishnah Sachir. It's written by Rav Teichtal, who's the author of the Eim HaBanim Smecha. So he quotes an idea from Rav Yitzchak of Berdichev, that is quoted in other svarim, that there is this idea in general, you find in the Torah where God says he's going to always remember the Egel Azav even after we've done tshuva, which doesn't seem fair. I mean, why should we be constantly reminded of the Egel Azav even after we have repented? So he quotes the idea that when we look at the concept, let's say, of Nasa V'Nishma, so sometimes if you have somebody who's from a distinguished family and he continues in the distinguished path, he continues learning Torah, things like that, so he doesn't get so much credit for it because it's expected, that's the tradition of the family. But if he were to go the other path, then he's really going to get embarrassed because, oh, even with such a background to go off the path of learning, that's something that's really disgraceful. But somebody with a weaker background doesn't come from a tradition of learning, so that person commits to the same life of learning, they're going to get much more credit because they don't have that whole background that was going to make that presumption. And if they didn't follow that path, they wouldn't be held with such accountability. So one might think that, okay, so here the Jewish people, they're descendants of Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. Of course they can accept the Torah. It's not even something to give them credit for. It's not even possible to do anything else. They didn't really have any Bechira. That was essentially the life path that was set before them by their ancestors. So Davka, it's to praise them, to say, no, that it's possible they could go the other way, that we see that there was an Egel Hazav too, that it was possible for the Jews to make a different choice. So the fact that the same Jewish people that had an Egel Hazav also accepts the Torah, don't say, yeah, just because they're descendants of Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. It could have been otherwise, and therefore they deserve credit for that. And so this isn't to embarrass the Jews that we're going to always remember the Egel Hazav, but it is to give them credit. It is something which should be positively acknowledged, and perhaps that's the point. There is a comment that Tzlach has in his Sefer on Pesachim. We mentioned yesterday, I think, that Tzlach, the author of Another Behuda. So in his Sefer on Pesachim, he discusses that the Gemara in Pesachim says that we know that we have to celebrate physically on Shavuos, that we have to have a aspect of good meals, chatzi lachem, because it's the Yom Shenitna Torah. The day the Torah was given, certainly it has an obligation to have good meals and to celebrate. And that's a fascinating line by itself, which is also a topic of a lot of discussion outside our scope. But the Tzlach asks, it wasn't always the case that it was the Yom Shenitna Torah, that if the Torah was given on the 6th of Sivan, so nowadays Shavuos is always on the 6th of Sivan, but we have a set calendar, but in the time when that statement was said, the Shavuos could have been the 5th or the 6th or the 7th, because counting 49 days from Pesach, with two Rosh Chodeshes in between that are unpredictable, it could be 5, 6, or 7. So the Tzlach develops this idea that really there are 3 days of Kabbalah Satorah, it's not one day. It says 5, 6, and 7 are all Kabbalah Satorah. And you have to understand why. It says 5 is because Nasa V'Nishma, that comes from the day before. That's the beginning of Kabbalah Satorah. And then 6 or 7, it's actually a machlokas in the Gemara whether it was 6 or 7. So Tosfos and Avodah Zarah says that if it was the 7th, so what's Peshat on the 6th? It's that HaKadosh Baruch Hu was going to give the Torah on the 6th, but the Gemara says that Moshe pushed things off for a day, and God agreed, so it ends up being on the 7th. So it says that you have 3 days of Kabbalah Satorah. You have the 5th, which is Nasa Menishma, the 6th, which is what was Roy to be Kabbalah Satorah, and then the 7th, which ended up being the case because of Moshe's host of Echad Midaitim, and of course a little synergy there because we mentioned earlier that this idea of Moshe adding on and God agreeing is one of the possible sources for the idea of Dinam Derabanan having a full mitzvah status, which is very much a part of this whole idea of Kabbalah Satorah. So all of this is very crucial in relating to this whole concept, and this is it's a big idea as well.
Hi. About the Chena Ego?
Yes.
That idea?
Yes.
It seems to be overstating that the Chena Ego was really sort of the deviating, in their opinion, that it really just sort of serving as a sheet of.
Well, yeah, but Lamaisa, we certainly relate to it as a chait. I mean, that's how the Rambam describes.
But it wasn't deviating from accepting the Torah.
It was a deviation that was significant enough, you know. Even though it's a difficult parsha, and maybe we'll be able to talk about that a little bit more in the weeks to come. The exact nature of the chait, but your point notwithstanding, we certainly relate to it as a tremendous stumbling. Now, is it as it could seem like as if it was a complete turning of the back? It seems like not 100%, although again, the Rambam, when he talks about the history of idolatry in the world, also sees all idolatry like that, but that's a worthwhile discussion to have in a different context. But for now, the idea that the Egel Hazav represents a big problem for Jewish history, that part we know. So to go into more detail, that we can do at a different time, but that much will take. So before we run out of time, just to highlight a few other ideas, just very quickly. So first of all, we'll skip around a little bit. So if you look at Pasuk Yud, so Pasuk Yud says, Vayiru, so here Moshe is going up with Nadav and Avihu, and Vayiru is Elohei Yisrael, V'sachas Ragov, K'masav Livna Sasapir, V'chetzim HaShemayim L'Tohar. So they saw God, that's what it sounds like. and that under his feet was like the working of a sapphire brick, and it was like heaven itself. So this pasuk is clearly very mysterious and very mystical. Rav Hirsch has a couple of different interpretations of what it means. It must mean that they saw how God expressed himself, or saw the impact of God. But the Chazal also suggests that this looking was a problem. So Rashi here, for example, says, Nastaklu v'hetzitzu v'neschaivu misa, that here referring to Nadav and Aviyu, that they looked and they became chayiv misa, ela shulo rotza, kadosh baruch hu la'arbei simchas ha'Torah. But God didn't want to mix that up with simchas ha'Torah and have Nadav Aviyu die then. V'himtim u'Nadav Aviyu at yom chanukas ha'mishkan, says Rashi. God waited until the day of the Chanukas HaMishkan for Nadav and Avihu to die. So in the Sefer Eish Tamid of Rav Druk, he has a discussion here that Yom the Mishkan was also a very happy day, and we have a tradition, maybe even happier, the day of Kabbalah Satorah. So if we're trying to prevent messing up the Simcha, we don't want to share the Simcha, so how come it happened on the day of Hakamas HaMishkan and not here? What's exactly the logic there? So he explained that it's not that we never want to share a simcha, I mean, we never do want to share a simcha, but it's not that there's a promise that every simcha is going to be left untouched. It's davka Kabbalah HaTorah requires a unadulterated simcha. That Kabbalah HaTorah needs simcha at its core in order to take place, and that is a crucial idea. There's the famous introduction that the Avi Nezer has to a sefer on Shabbos, the Eglei Tal, where he has a discussion. I've actually had this experience in real life. Somebody asked me this question. Then he describes that there are people who ask that they feel bad that they learn Torah and they enjoy it. So what's the problem? The problem is they feel like it's not lishma. They feel like they're not doing it for the right reasons. And they feel guilty about it. They get such a geschmack out of learning. Is that really a mitzvah? And the Avi Nezer responds, he writes over there, says, not only is it okay, not only is it not a problem of not lishma, he says, that is lishma, that the lishma of Torah means that you connect so greatly to it. This is consistent with what we were saying a few minutes ago from Rav Soloveitchik and the Beis Halevi, the whole idea of nasa v'nishma, it's that you connect so profoundly to the Torah's content that you feel very happy, that you enjoy it a tremendous amount. And he says, I would say the opposite. I would say that if you were to come and tell me that you learn but you're miserable, then I would say I'm not sure you're in fulfillment of any mitzvah, and that's a problem. So to here, this is what the Eish Talmud is suggesting, that there is a condition that it has to be b'simcha, otherwise there's something very serious missing. Otherwise there's a big problem. Just to call your attention to this next pasuk, Atzilei B'nai Yisrael. So Atzilei B'nai Yisrael, this whole idea, what does this word Atzilei mean? We use this nowadays in contemporary Hebrew to mean something like nobility. And you should look at the Ramban, if you should give a Maramach, you look at the Ramban, and look at Sefer Som Derech of Rav Simcha Zussel Breud, has a little bit about this, the notion that these are people who showed some restraint, and that's a big element of what we respect. And we talk about tznius is about restraint, and the reason that we praise people with the word being tznuim, that we use this idea of tznius as one of the core values in life, is because it represents this kind of restraint, which I don't think he mentions this point, but it's consistent with what the Gemara says, that the Gemara describes how in the Beis HaMikdash by the Lechem HaPanim, there were people who used to fight over getting a little bit of the Lechem HaPanim to eat, but that tznuah moshe misidayim, that the people who had tznius, the people who were more modest, they would restrain themselves. They, even for the mitzvah, they're not going to push other people out of the way. They're not going to elbow their way in. And that's midas tznius that we have great respect for, and that's essentially the same idea of atzilus. That's a worthwhile topic to take a look at as well. So much to talk about in this aliyah. So just to say, maybe a few quick more ideas and then we'll dive in. But there's a very fascinating idea towards the end of the aliyah. Pasuk Yudalid. So here, as Moshe is going up towards the mountain, it's Vel Zakenim Amar Shvu Lonu Vazeh Adashanosh Valechim. So he says to them, he says to the Zakenim, he says, you guys sit here until we come back. So Chazal have a comment. There's a medrash that Rashi doesn't quote this, but this idea of Shvu Lanu Vazeh, right? It tells the Zakenim to wait. Shvu Lanu, sit for us. What does that mean, sit for us? Like Avram, when he went up to the Akedah, so he said to those who were with him, Shvu Lachem, you should sit. So what is Shvu Lanu, sit for us? So Chazal say two answers. Either that he was just trying to be respectful, so he was equating his covenant with their covenant and saying, all of us together, or that his message was that we're about to go into this very scary looking place with all kinds of supernatural forces that are swirling around, and you should sit here and daven for us that we should come out okay. So there's a fascinating statement, a fascinating discussion of this in the Sefer Shari Ora. Shari Ora is a beautiful Sefer in general of Rav Meir Tzvi Bergman, who happens to be the son-in-law of Rav Shach. He has beautiful essays in the Sefer. It's come out in a couple of maduris. So recently, a few years ago, they published a new edition of the Shari Ora with new thoughts in it. So in one of his more recent sichos, he says that what's going on here? What's exactly pshat in these two explanations that Chazal have in this pasuk? So he notes is that really there's also support for the idea that the Zakenim were supposed to go with Moshe, but they were essentially punished because they were also supposed to go with Moshe to Paro, and they didn't come through with that. They left him hanging, so therefore they didn't get to come here either. So essentially they were being punished by being told they had to stay back. But Moshe Rabbeinu realized, okay, this is Kabbalah Satorah. Derech Eretz Kadma LaTorah. He has to express Derech Eretz as he's receiving the Torah. So what's the Derech Eretz? So even as they're being forced to stay back, he says so in a respectful way, so he includes himself in it. And look at this chaf, look at the sensitivity that he makes up. Oh, you know, we need you there. We need you to stay here and to daven on our behalf. This is an important job for you that you can do for us. Do me a favor and stay here and daven on our behalf. That was tremendous sensitivity to their kavod, that even though it was really a price that they were paying, he transmitted it in a way that made it seem like they were doing him a favor, and that's a tremendous derech eretz. That's part of the idea of derech eretz kadma l'Torah. Certainly should be aware, this we could talk about forever, but the end of the pasuk, mi bal dvarim yigash aleihem. So that is the source, the Gemara says in Bava Kamma, that is the source for the idea of Hamotzi Mechaber Olav Haraya. Now, just also a little synergy, the Gemara there also asks, why do we need any source for Hamotzi Mechaber Olav Haraya? Why don't we say that it's a Svara, and the Svara has a din like a din in HaTorah? That's a discussion that alludes to what we've talked about in the past. But in any event, the Gemara does quote this pasuk, as Rav Hirsch explains how the pasuk should be read, that mi bal dvarim, you could have thought that means the person who has bialus, the person who is in ownership of something, should be the one to bring a raya. He says, no, it's not, it's bal dvarim. Bal dvarim is the one who has what to say. Somebody who has a claim against somebody else, somebody who wants to say that you owe me money, right? The muchzak is not the toveya in general. The muchzak is the one who's happy to be left alone. He has his item. The one who wants to change something is the one who's not the muchzak. So you who wants to change something, you who wants to come with a claim that somebody should give you something, so yigash aleihem, you should come with a raya, you should come and bring a proof that a burden is on you. So that's how to read that part of the pasuk. But also aleihem, to the dayanim, that's also supposed to, at the same time, connote a certain accessibility of the dayanim, and he says there are certain halachas there that are derived from that point as well, that we do give the plaintiff certain priority in terms of presenting his arguments and related dinim, because that's also derived from the pasuk. Okay, so I'll just mention one last idea. We're over time already, but the pasuk ends, V'yava Moshe b'solcha anan, I mean the Ali ends, that Moshe comes in the middle of a cloud, and Rashi adds here, anan zek min ashanhu, it's like smoke, v'asol ha'karish baruch Moshe shvil b'solcha. And God made a path for him in the middle of the smoke, in the middle of this cloud. And Rav Moshe Feinstein has a comment on this pasuk, that this is the way things were, because we have to understand that even though we have Torah Shel Chassav, we have the written Torah, but it's always going to be something that's going to take a lot of effort. It's never going to be easy. It's never going to be just laid out in a very clear way. And we're always going to need the shvil. We're always going to need a path. We're always going to need some help from the previous generations, from the Chachamim, from the Chachmei HaMesorah, and that's what's conveyed in this process as well, that we should understand that there is an inherent challenge and complexity always in fully understanding the Torah, and that's the way it is, and that's something that we happily embrace. Okay, again, it's a very loaded aliyah, so much more to say, but hopefully this gives us a little bit of the taste. Moshe, you're down for us? You're okay, so Leib, you want to down for us? Okay, back? Okay.